MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
Hi, you guys. Welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Well, Iran. We used to say Russia. We're going to be discussing that today with Mick Mulroy, Michael Patrick Mulroy, a former Marine and a CIA paramilitary officer who became the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. So he has a lot to say about what's going on with Iran today. But there are actually some other things going on, right?
It's a big world out there. But one that really struck me this week was a great story in the Washington Post by Catherine Belton, who's been a longtime Kremlin watcher, about how the Russian security services were planning on staging a fake assassination attempt on Viktor Orban in Hungary as a way to boost his prospects in apparently at what is turning out to be a very close reelection campaign. Now, obviously, Orban has been a longtime ally of the Russians. While being a NATO member. And, you know, there's been concerns about him leaking NATO intelligence to the Kremlin. Certainly, and Belton points this out in the article, there's like multiple lines of, you know, corrupt payments from various entities linked to the Kremlin into Hungary, and many going to cronies and confederates of Orban. But the fake assassination attempt was labeled in documents, and Belton had some of these internal SVR documents saying they were pitching that idea as a game changer in the upcoming Hungarian election.
And it looks like he's going to lose that election as it stands right now.
Right now, the polls are not looking good for him. But, you know, and of course, if he does lose, I have it on good authority that the EU would be, every other country will be celebrating.
Yeah, be out in the streets.
He's blocked funding for Ukraine to some extent, or loans. But so this is a big deal, but it also shows the extent to which the Russians see the war in Ukraine, see their hybrid war in Europe, which involves sabotage and espionage and assassinations. You know, this would be one more element of their hybrid war.
Yeah, you know, some listeners might think, well, how obscure it is to be talking about Hungary, but the future of the cohesion of NATO is critically important at this particular time because Trump has spent years dumping on NATO, and many leaders in the EU are saying, hey, the U.S. is no longer our ally and may even be our opponent someday, vice the threats to invade Greenland and so on. NATO having cohesion and getting a leader in Hungary who would help strengthen the alliance is really, really important. And it does relate even to the war we're having with Iran.
Yeah, so, and this has been a concern that's been expressed for weeks now, that, you know, the more we get bogged down in Iran, the more it takes away from helping to fund the Ukrainian defenses against the Russian invaders. And that places more importance on the Europeans to take
but actually,
up
Hungary,
what could be the slack.
I think this is actually the Hungarian election is actually pivotal for many things, not just NATO and, you know, how much it means for Russia, you know, in terms of you know, re-enlivening the, to pick a bad word, the old, you know, Soviet Union. But Hungary has been an issue for those of us in the democracy leading world for quite a long time, as somebody who worked there after 1989. I want to say that you know, seeing a change on the horizon in Hungary would be an incredible message in terms of changes elsewhere. It's beyond even the geopolitical aspect of it. It's what's happening with Europe. What's the future of Europe? To what extent is the right wing, you know, growing? And to what extent are other forces, other democratic forces, growing? No?
You know, in the weird way that history sometimes rhymes if it doesn't repeat itself, a lot of people have drawn analogies in the Iran conflict to 1956, when the British and the French and the Israelis invaded Egypt to open up the Suez Canal. And of course, what happened right after that? The Hungarian rebellion. And there were two major crises on the world stage at that very moment. And so it's kind of interesting that, you know, Hungary could be back on the front pages again as the Iran war, as the Iran conflict.
But we've also been watching this these terrorism threats from Iran, or terrorism threats that have been raised about Iran. You've been looking at that, Garen, right?
Yeah, I've noticed that there have been a number of stories that have talked very vaguely about the idea of threats, not so much from, you know, within the United States, but from outside the United States, say off the Pacific coast, which is where some specifics have come in terms of missiles being launched and some kind of attack coming that way as a terrorist attack. And I don't know how much credibility this has or what it is, but it seems to me to be taking on a little more of concern than the sort of, oh, there could possibly be at some point some kind of inside terrorist attack. And I just wonder who's paying attention to this. And what the reality of it is, and what's just floating around as possibility. But
is there anybody running counterterrorism?
Yeah, no, but
here?
That's right.
Well, the guy in charge just resigned, right?
Yeah, no,
Joe Kent was the director of the National Counterterrorism Center. So at a time when there is, like,
that's right,
you know, the threat level has increased quite a bit, yeah, he decides to, you know, yeah, leave and the stage.
And I'm hoping somebody's paying attention, but I've been trying to dig around to see who would it be, who, you know, where, what would the office, the person, et cetera, be. And I haven't found an answer. So if you guys find an answer, let me know.
Not to mention all the FBI agents have been fired, some of whom were experts in Iranian subversion. So,
Not to mention that DHS, whose mission was counterterrorism in terms of, you know, including at our borders, has gone in a completely other direction. And so you really kind of wonder where exactly what's going on there. What is the Coast Guard doing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, see, it might be easier to slip through American airports now, except the lines.
Well, you'd have to wait on long lines if
even
you were going to slip through.
Even the terrorists have to wait for long lines
to
get
funny.
On a plane. But it might be a good place to drop a bomb, now that I'm suggesting that anyone do so. Of course, I don't want to. I doubt that any of the people do that need me to suggest what they should be doing. Anyway, we're going to be swinging back to Iran. We got a great guest today, Mick Mulroy, who's been a CIA paramilitary officer, a Marine, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. And he's coming up right now. Mick Mulroy, welcome to Spy Talk. You are a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. On top of being a former CIA paramilitary officer and a Marine, what do you think about the Middle East today with Iran? Are we seeing Iran in a hard place? What's it looking like to you?
So great to be with you guys, all of you. I would say that we're at a crossroads right now. We obviously have made great strides on our military objectives. There's certainly, we can talk about how we got into the war and how imminent the threat actually was. It wasn't.
Sure.
It was a war of choice. Again, focusing on where we are now, I think the U.S. has all the incentive to try to find a diplomatic path out of this. I think we should not only give negotiations a chance, we should do our main effort right now on negotiations with Iran, knowing we're going to have to compromise on some areas. If that's the case, and we can end this conflict, but and of course have the Strait of Hormuz open, then I think, for the most part, the U.S. has met its military objectives. One could still argue about the strategic objectives, sure. But the other route, the other fork, and I think that's where you're going, Jeff, is if Iran does not want to participate, and their public statements indicate that, looks like we're going to go to a pretty substantial escalation because we have several ground elements that are en route to the area right now.
I must say, at this point, it reminds me of my war, which is the Vietnam War, and the communist strategy back then was capsulized in talk, talk, fight, fight, or fight, fight, talk, talk. It seems to me the Iranians, this is another layer of the Iranians' virtual guerrilla strategy. They're going to talk, 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 let Trump, you know, he wants to float the markets and so on with the negotiations. But the Iranians actually might have the upper hand right now. What do you think about that? Would you say, is that true or no?
So it has shifted somewhat. At first, it was a conventional military conflict, war. And we have an overmatch, obviously, of essentially every country on Earth, including Iran. But it has shifted. It has shifted to an economic war of attrition, and that is much more in line with where Iran wants to go. They can take a lot of pain. We know that from the Iran-Iraq war going all the way back that far, when they essentially sent a whole generation of children to simply clear minefields. So that level of willingness to take pain, if it still exists, and I think it does, at least in the regime, is very difficult to contend with, especially when we're a democracy. And it's already an unpopular war by just looking at all of the polls that have been done. And we are putting an economic strain on our partners and allies around the world, which, of course, are telling us about that. So there is a real, I think, incentive for the United States to, again, find a diplomatic path forward, because simply seizing these islands that we're talking about, Karg Island, Larak, Abu Musa, and others around the Straits. Yes, I have, as you mentioned, I'm a Marine. I have full confidence in the Marine Corps. If they're given the task, they will complete it. But the question is, to what end, right? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I think it's a big question right now, whether this would actually help by trying to force the Strait open or potentially make it worse, because Iran, of course, gets a boat. They can start targeting, again, our partners in the region to include oil and gas infrastructure, which would send energy prices even higher, which would compound the issue for us. And again, this is an economic war of attrition right now, in my estimation, and the center of gravity is the Strait.
You know, Jeff's mention of Vietnam, what instantly comes to mind when you said that is that that's probably the supreme example of how you could, how fighting can continue to go on even while negotiations and talking. How many years were the Paris peace talks going on while the Vietnam War on the ground was raging and Americans were getting killed? So the mere fact that there might be some talks in Pakistan or wherever is no guarantee that they're going to quickly resolve the war itself. But I did want to ask, Mick, just on the threatened escalation here, the seizure of Karg Island and maybe some of those other islands, you know, what exactly do you think the mission would be? Because they seize the islands, it's kind of has all these oil facilities on it. They're essentially occupying Iranian territory. And for how long? And to what extent do they become sitting ducks for drones and missiles hiding in the mountains up there? They're not going to have interceptors for air defenses. You know, I can see all sorts of nightmarish scenarios.
Well, actually, I have to interrupt here and just say that I wrote yesterday about a war game in 2002 in which they played out the scenario. And the U.S. forces got crushed. The U.S. Navy fleet in this war game was sunk in 10 minutes, including an aircraft carrier. So the question becomes, what happens when you take Karg Island? The taking is easy. The staying there is very hard. And Mick, back to you on that.
Yeah, so I'll start with often used series of quotes from the Vietnam War, right, where the American colonel says, you know, to the Vietnamese colonel, we beat you in every battle. And the Vietnamese colonel said, yes, you did, and it's entirely irrelevant, right? So, and I bring that up because just because we can doesn't mean it necessarily advances our strategic interest. But to put both sides out there, the idea, and this is something that the United States Strait of Hormuz and Karg Island, we've been talking about since the 80s, right? So the idea this was a surprise, I think, is just nonsensical. It certainly wasn't a surprise when I was at the Pentagon, and I don't think ever since. But so the question, the argument for it, to be fair to both sides here, is that you seize the island, it's 90% of their processing for their oil, and then you keep it at risk rather than just destroy it, because then there's nothing to bargain with, to get them to open the strait. If it works, I'll be the first one to say, great. the question is, so they are planning for it. We can see the reports, as you would expect. I mean, they're mining the place both for personnel, vehicles, anti-tank, anti-armor, you name it, shoulder-launched surface-to-air missiles. They're getting ready for this. So it's not going to be easy. The chances that we would lose submarines and potentially paratroopers from the 82nd, very high. And then, of course, it's only 15 miles off the coast of Iran, so we can expect constant bombardment. And both bring some level of protection, but really not the necessary level of protection to stay there for an extended period. So I'm just talking the military part, and then I'll get into
Point, how would the troops, the Marines, defend themselves from drone and missile attacks on Karg Island? Because there's not going to be built-in air defenses and interceptors to knock them down.
So they'll bring some, and they'll have to put a massive air envelope over all of this, right? So near nonstop suppression of enemy incoming at Karg Island and potentially around the strait itself. Will it be perfect? Absolutely not. There is no air defense system that's perfect. But there definitely won't be perfect. So there is the question of how would we be adequately defending our forces once they took the island? And then what if Iran says, so what? Like, we're not going to give up the strait. You've taken Karg. You got it, right? So then we have Marines that are under fire nonstop and potentially paratroopers if they're going to use them with the Marines nonstop. For what purpose? And that's why I think, I don't want to speak for him, but he's with me at the Middle East Institute. General Votel challenged the efficacy of this as a military operation. And, you know, I think I have knowledge in this area, but General Votel was the CENTCOM commander. So you should take heed, obviously, for when he tells you, I don't really see the exact task and purpose for taking Karg Island as far as this goes, because the Iranians could simply say, well, we're still not opening the strait. So then it goes, then it shifts back to the strait and whether taking the key terrain features around it would adequately protect our minesweepers, which they would probably launch most of their mines, and we expect they have like 5,000 of them. Most of our minesweepers are what we use as minesweepers now. That's another discussion, right? We decommissioned the Avenger class minesweepers. So we're going to find out what these work adequately, these littoral combat ships that are outfitted with this. At the same time, we're defending the area. And then if that works, and obviously I hope it does, whether the commercial shipping companies will still believe that it's safe to pass through there, and whether the insurance companies of those commercial vessels believe that it is. Because just us doing it militarily, which could cost us fairly dearly with casualties, doesn't necessarily mean the strait's open. Just because we militarily bless it does not indicate necessarily that it's going to be used. So we could still end up in the same position of a effectively closed strait because the passageway is not deemed safe by those that need to pass it.
You know, it's interesting listening to you talk about General Votel and yourself and sort of assessing what the possibilities are going forward. But I have a question for you about the chain of command and the way the decisions are being made about next steps in Washington. And you've been at the Pentagon, and who do you think is contributing to the risk analysis, to the plans going forward? Do you get a sense that, you know, it's more than just the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and Secretary Hegseth? I mean, how exactly do you assess that? How do you value it? Would you make any changes if you were recommending how things are decided?
So that's a good question, Karen. So I was there, of course, with Secretary Mattis, one of the greater leaders of our generation, and things were quite different. I mean, I don't know, to be fair, I don't know what it's like now, but we see the reports that the historic national security process is not the same in this administration. And the first administration, we had, for example, General McMaster over there, obviously General, our Secretary Mattis. It was, everything was planned out. Everybody had a say. Everybody was listened to. Obviously, the uniform military was. That's their point. That's their purpose. They are the ultimate when it comes to the best military advice. From what, and I'm only going by what I've seen in reports, this was essentially decided with the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, of defense, and the chairman was there, which is important. But that's not really the norm. In the past, no matter what party it was, there was a robust policy discussion that included how are we going to strategically message this. You know, for example, you should not have one person come out and say it was an imminent threat because Iran has ICBMs, only to be told by the intelligence community that they were 9 years away from possessing an ICBM, or have the secretary come out and say, Secretary of State, that is, come out and say, well, we went to war because Iran was going to go to, I mean, Iraq, Israel, excuse me, was going to go to war, and they were going to respond against them and us, so we just preempted. And then have the president, you know, contradict that almost immediately, right? That's one part of it, but it's an important part because that sets the standard for whether the American people trust that you know what you're doing when you have, you know, a real consistent reason for choosing to go to war. And I agree with the military objectives, right? So I'm not just a naysayer here, but the national security process, starting, you know, at a fairly low level, senior for government standards, but that works its way up so that by the time the principals get it, a lot of the issues have already been discussed. The pros, the cons, the everything that needs to be taken into consideration is presented in a way that's very digestible and they can make informed decisions. Maybe that process is underway now, but everything we've seen that's come out of the media says it is not the same as it has been in other
administrations. We don't want to burnish the blob, as we call it, the foreign policy establishment in Washington, too much. After all, there was lots of intelligence saying there was no WMD in Iraq, and the political decision was made at the top to invade Iraq, which was not turned out so well. Speaking of Iraq, the Iranians have begun, Iranian-backed militias have begun attacking U.S. forces in Iraq. What do you think about that? Is that, are we in a pickle there or what?
We are. I mean, this isn't new, right? Those groups have been, the Hashd al-Shaabi has been attacking the U.S. positions there for quite some time. They are obviously trying to use every leverage point they have. Hezbollah, of course, and that's a whole other issue. We could probably have a whole episode on what's going to happen. And we would be if it wasn't for the broader war against Iran. Of course, we'd be talking a lot more about what's happening in Lebanon now. But your question, Jeff, certainly in Iraq, it has been an issue for the United States. It's going to increase as, you know, we've decided whether we should stay militarily. We've decided to significantly reduce our presence to the point of just having a, you know, a diplomatic military attaché, essentially. This could expedite it, but we don't want it to expedite it because it would look like we're conceding ground, if you will, literal ground, to the enemy at this time. So that's going to be something the U.S. has to deal with. At the same time, we're trying to both, I think, from listening to President Trump's statement, and yes, it's maybe hyperbolic about how these negotiations are going, but in my looking for a positive in this, I think he's projecting what he wants to see. I think he wants to see an Iran that's willing to compromise and work with the U.S. to get to a ceasefire. So I hope that is where we're headed, because, again, the alternate is not, and I think, in our interest. Could we force the strait open? Potentially. but that could cause us a whole lot of other issues in the process.
Speaking of credibility and what the president wants, I mean, a lot of us looked at his statement Monday morning that, you know, I'm postponing the threat about the power plants because we're making great progress with negotiations. And a lot of people, obviously, that has not been confirmed by any Iranian to date, at least publicly. And it looks a lot like that was a statement for stabilizing the markets because he was fearing there was going to be a crash and a financial panic that day because of the threat that he had just made. What do you make of what the president said about that? You're saying he was hoping that maybe saying the kinds of things he says that he, in his mind, he believes that can bring it to reality. But certainly the Iranian response has not been encouraging on that score.
Agreed, Michael. I mean, essentially the first timeline was what, 48 hours? And then The Iranians gave us a list of everything that they would respond to, which would, of course, exacerbate the very issue that they've gained by taking over the Strait of Hormuz. So I think on their demands, I mean, some of the things are obviously never going to be agreed to, right? We're not going to agree never to attack them again because we don't know what they're going to do. We can't actually give them sovereignty over the Strait of Hormuz. We're only one of 193 countries, and there's an international waterway. We don't even have the authority to do that, right? And then several other things, reparations. I mean, we're not going to do that. That would have to be approved by Congress, of course. So that's not going to happen. But what I'm hoping is that these are maximalist positions that are publicly being stated. Not sure why we even need to do any of this publicly. But that when we get behind closed doors, if we get to that point, that both sides understand the negotiations have to have compromise. You can't come in with absolutes and expect it to go anywhere. That's what I'm concerned about. I think we all know that the president is fine with giving deadlines and then shifting them. So perhaps we'll get to the end of this 5-day deadline.
The 5-day deadline ends Friday when this podcast will go live.
Right. So
what does he do then?
Well, remember, Trump always chickens out.
Well, and then we also expect the first elements of the, you know, immediate response force from the 82nd to arrive this weekend. And I think the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit should be there around Wednesday or Thursday. I'm not quite sure, but the other part of this, and the Iranians might be looking at this as the most likely course of action, if you will, is that this is just a way for us to get ground forces in position, so that they don't take these negotiations very serious. And I think one of the things that we can somewhat take the blame for is we were in the middle of negotiations and we had another meeting set for Monday and we attacked them on Friday. So you can see, you know, as much as, you know, I don't like the Iranian regime, I think it'd be great if they went away. You can see from their perspective that they'd be a little cautious in whether this is a real effort at negotiations or simply, you know, to buy time to get, in this case, ground forces in the right position.
Mick, we have to take a short break to give our sponsors a second to tout their wares, and we'll be back. Okay, we're back. Mick, given your background in CIA, paramilitary, ground forces, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if I'm not wrong, you participated in that war game back when U.S. forces were introduced into the Gulf. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah, sounds like a guy that can't hold a job, right? But yes, we did. I mean, obviously, if the U.S. military does anything, well, if we do a lot, great. But one of the things that we do that's really outstanding is plan for everything.
Yeah.
Right. Well, plan for everything.
Let me ask you about your role in that war game. Were you on the red team or the blue team?
Well, ultimately, I was on the policy side of that. So we were participants, but ultimately, once the policy decision is made, hence the war game, then it's turned over to, of course, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But the operational commander, which is the GCC commanders, which, as we already mentioned at the time, was General Votel, so the central command. And then the war game plays usually internal to us. They play both sides. So it's military on military.
Well, a uniform Marie, military. Yeah. As I reminded people yesterday of earlier Washington Post and Army Times reporting years ago, the Red Team under Marine General Van Riper creamed the U.S. forces. He sunk his guerrilla fighters and flexible commanders using, you know, shutting off radio communications, moving around quickly and so on, almost like Viet Cong style, defeated the U.S. fleet in 10 minutes, sunk an aircraft carrier and so on and so forth. I was wondering, from your vast experience in general, but particular with that war game, if you were put yourself in the shoes of the IRGC commander right now, what are you thinking about doing? What are your moves right now?
And the IRGC commanders right now are in charge. Let's be clear about that.
What would you do?
Right. So, but I want, my point being is they're probably more hardline than the entire decapitation strike that took out the supreme leader on Dow. So that is who's making the call now. We got, you know, Arachi as the foreign minister. You've got Galibov, who is the Speaker of the Parliament, but IRGC, both of them have fought in the past as combatants. What would I be doing? Largely what they are doing right now. They have the one, you want to use what you have left of your strategic weapons, ballistic missiles, especially hypersonic, and in to extent, a certain extent, the suicide drones sparingly. You want to, because you want to have the ability to react if we escalate. So it's not just like we're going to shoot it at a target because we want to show that we still have them. If we take an island, if we're about to take an island, if I was them, I would go ahead and dump everything into the Strait of Hormuz, right?
Dump everything. You mean everything. Missiles, drones, mines?
Well, specifically the naval mines. The naval mines, right? So we think a couple hundred so far. Again, just going off reports. We believe they have 5,000. So that could take months, essentially. And that would dramatically, and I would pass that information, since we already have some kind of diplomatic or maybe through the intelligence services. If I was them, I'd say, look, this is like a, you know, I used to coach boxing. This is like a slow motion right hook. We see the Mew coming across from the Pacific. We see the Mew coming across from the Atlantic. We might see the paratroopers arrive here this weekend. It takes hours to dump all these sea mines in the Strait. They could simply tell us, if you guys keep going with this, that's what's going to happen. Yes, it'll hurt them for sure. But right now, I think the IRG is saying, well, okay, so by closing the strait, we now charge every boat or ship that's coming through here. They claim 2 million, right? But we also are about to sell $14 billion worth of oil that the United States is now allowed to be sold because we removed sanctions on them. So financially, they're winning. Because of their control of the strait.
Okay, so, flip to the other side now, Mick. Mm-hmm. So you're the U.S. commander. All the sea mines have been laid in the strait. How do you respond to that? Or can you guess how Trump, from your previous experience, how Trump's going to respond to that? Could this, I don't want to use the word that comes to mind, but could Trump escalate in a very dangerous way?
Yes. I think that is possible, if not probable. The immediate kind of emotional reaction to this, not saying that's what it'll have, is to say, okay, well, you've just escalated this substantially, which they would have if they did this. We're going to attack you. That's why I'm saying I would keep my weapons so that I could respond to that, right? Because they need to know that they want us to know that they can. Right. So we have reduced, 60%, 70%. You see different numbers on the launchers and all this, but they have the ability to hide a lot of these in areas that are very difficult for us to hit, even using our massive ordnance penetrators. And they're very good at coming out really quickly, launching and then hiding again. So that's what they had. That's asymmetric warfare, right? So it's a huge country, four times the size of Iraq. I mean, even the coastline that we're talking about, if we had to go through the strait and go up to get to Karg Island is like the entire coastline of California. So it's important that Americans understand, like, as dominant as our military is, they're not omnipotent, and they certainly can't be everywhere. So they're going to launch and likely hit things like the North Dome, which is the gas fields for Qatar. They've already reduced them 17%. They could reduce them 60%. And then what does that do to the international cost of energy? And it's not just a cost. Some countries are now like going to 4-day work weeks or shutting down plants. I mean, this affects all of them. And it's more important, I think, to the United States than it is to Iran, who is already isolated from the international community, especially economically. So from their perspective, they're like, not much different. From our perspective, it's every country around the world is now looking at us to do something about the economic crisis that they're going to believe we caused.
Nick, can I just follow up on just talking about sort of your larger portfolio and the things you've paid attention to in the world, which are not just war, but also humanitarian efforts. And I'm curious, you know, it's so interesting in watching all the coverage of the war, how little has been about who's suffering, and I don't mean politically or, you know, militarily, who's suffering, what the plans are, both in Lebanon and in Iran. And I figured you might know something about this, or at least what people are thinking or who's talking. And, you know, we don't have USAID like we did before. There are other organizations that have been crippled recently. Can you just talk a little bit about that dimension of the ongoing, you know, fallout from this conflict?
Absolutely, Karen. So yes, we do that. That's one of the main efforts of the group I'm involved in. It basically veterans that work to deliver humanitarian aid into very difficult places. That's why they call us, right? Whether it's airdrops, or we worked on the maritime corridor for Gaza. We worked at airdrops in Sudan, South Sudan. We were about to start in Lebanon, to be frank. So there's a couple issues, right? So there's a massive reduction in foreign assistance around the world. The United States obviously has decided that we are going to contribute substantially less than we have in the past. U.S. aid being closed is a big issue, not only for the people who would rely on those kind of assistance, which hasn't gone away. If anything, it's increased. People needing food, people needing critical medicines, largely caused by conflicts that won't end, but also our soft power. Our soft power has gone down to very little, you know, at a time when our reputation is somewhat challenged around the world for our challenging alliances and traditional historical partners and allies. So that's a big issue. And you're right. I mean, look at Lebanon right now. If it wasn't for the war in Iran, we'd be talking a lot about it more. But 1 million people have already been displaced. 1 million people have already been displaced. These are causing and will cause even more humanitarian crises. And right now, and it's not just the U.S., by the way, it's also Europe has reduced substantially their contribution to the international humanitarian assistance, partly because they're now focused on Ukraine, because we're less focused on Ukraine, and they're more focused on their defense because they feel that NATO isn't necessarily what it used to be. So there's a lot of issues when it comes to the humanitarian front, and it's not being addressed. And but it hasn't gone away. It just hasn't been covered as much as obviously, I mean, I'm biased, but I think it should be.
So, Mick, you have a pretty interesting resume. Before you were doing policy at the Pentagon, you were a Marine, and then you were a CIA paramilitary officer. Tell us how that came about, and to the extent that you can, what you were doing at the CIA.
Well, I mean, obviously, Michael, that's a very sensitive special activity.
To the extent that you can.
Yes, yeah, no, I get right. it. I appreciate the caveat. I'm just doing it so I don't get a call from the seventh floor. You know, I said that there's only so much I could talk about. What's generally known, essentially, is the agency has, obviously collect clandestine intelligence around the world. But we've also always had conduct covert action as the president sees fit. And one of the capacities to do that is what's called the Special Activity Center. This is all public. And that is where I was. They exist to carry out presidential covert action findings and to support, essentially the U.S. national security establishment if needed. Generally speaking, we always think of it being completely separate, but that capacity also exists to support, say, JSOC operations, for example. It's not all in support of us, but that capacity exists, and it is at a level that, you know, in the past just wasn't seen, but it increased substantially under the, you know, wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the global war on terrorism, if you will. And it has, I think it has really, you know, from what I saw while being there, it went from a small, somewhat secluded is maybe not the best word, but somewhat separate from the regular agency to now being completely integrated. Completely integrated everything we do. The officers that serve there often go on to serve in other positions throughout the agency or at large. And that's exactly the way it should be. It should be a capability that exists.
This sounds like an elegant filibuster, Mick. Tell us tell us what you did as much as you can.
Yeah.
Can you say, were you in Afghanistan?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I came in, right, you know, before September 11th, like all of my peers at the time, we spent a vast majority of our time in, yes, I was in Afghanistan early on, Iraq on the Nile team, you know, when it first went in to the north. And then after that, it was, you know, you name it, Yemen, Libya, Somalia. And then, of course, in, you know, because then I, again, this, I don't want to get into too much details and get the phone call, but I don't think I was exceptional. I think I was very common for a paramilitary operation officer at CERT during my time. We spent a lot of time in conflict zones, both declared, undeclared, and yes. And then I was ready to retire and come right here to Whitefish, Montana with my business partner, who is a retired SEAL commander from JSOC. And then I got the call because he had, my business partner had two more years. I got the call from Secretary Mattis's chief of staff, who said he's looking for people who aren't political to help serve as his deputies to help shape policy. So as my son said, who's also a Marine, you can't say no, Dad. Turn your car around. And
having been a part of the intelligence community for many years, as you look at its current state under ODNI, under Tulsi Gabbard, and the CIA under John Ratcliffe, what's your sense of how they are doing? We've had a lot to say, particularly about Gabbard on this podcast. But I'd be interested in particular about what's your sense is of the current state of the covert capabilities that you worked so closely in.
I think every year they get more capable. And, you know, I know all the leadership there now. And I think we have, you know, what I'm talking about is a special activities component, and they're very capable, and they take all the lessons learned from the last 20 years of fighting. And I think they can apply it across the spectrum, right? So whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Venezuela, you know, assisting in the capture of Maduro. And I'm not saying that it's somebody telling me from inside, but we saw, you know, the media reports, which I think were coming obviously from somebody inside, about how substantial the CIA effort was to capture Maduro. You can talk about the policy of it, but the actual execution of it was flawless, right? So according to the media, there was a team inserted by the agency in there that assisted directly into that incredible operation done by Delta, right? So I think that we are tactically and operationally, we are humming. And also the decapitation strike in Iran, right? I mean, there's been a New York Times report that it was largely based on CIA intelligence. If that is accurate, at least on the operational side, which is where the agency's supposed to be. We don't do policy, right? We're supposed to collect intelligence and then carry out covert action. I think the agency is humming, right? I think that now the other issue you brought up was DNI. Very challenged, I think, because they're doing things or being tasked to do things that just aren't what the DNI does. The DNI does not, for example, and I don't do domestic.
It's not an action agency.
But we shouldn't be involved in legal subpoena, we being the DNI, of, you know, voting fraud. I mean, there's no explanation for why we would have anything to do with that. And then, of course, the most recent is the idea that only the president makes the determination whether there something is an imminent threat. The intelligence community's job is to identify imminent threats. I mean, the committee meeting was called the Global Threat Analysis for the year. So that is exactly what we do. It's up to the president to make preemptive strikes on countries, of course, but the intelligence community's job, if it's anything, is to identify threats. And then, of course, if they're imminent, bring it to the attention of somebody immediately.
What you're referring to is Tulsi Gabbard's statement at the Congress that the president is the ultimate intelligence decider. So, I mean, we could go on and on about Tulsi Gabbard, and we have. But we got to bring this to a close. But I promise you, before we do bring it to a close, you talk about the conference you're hosting out there, Whitefish.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Maybe we'll get you guys out here to do a podcast. So this,
idea
sounds great. So I like it.
So what happened was there's a group that does a lot of conferences. They asked me to be on a panel, and I, of course, asked where it was because that matters. And they were like, "Well, Whitefish." I was like, "Well, that you answer the right question there." And then they found out Lobo Institute, which is the company I'm in.
The Lobo Institute. What is that? Tell us about that.
So Lobo Institute is a group of former government folks, yes, mostly military, but also diplomats and humanitarians, obviously a lot of CIA folks, and a lot of military, particularly special operations folks. It comes together to do three things: humanitarian stuff we already talked about. We do a lot of tactical training in the next generation that we think that needs to know about the future of ground combat. And then we do media in this security summit. So they wanted to pair with us because we're here and we have a lot of the people they're interested in. But the summit itself is the Whitefish Security Summit. The intent behind it is to have policy people with practitioners. And what I mean by practitioners is the people who have always been tasked with carrying out policy, right? So military and CIA, diplomats, humanitarians. So we want to have an interface, not just have a bunch of policy people fly to some far out place and then just talk to the same people they could have talked back in DC to. This, the idea is to bring the two together. It has a strong, soft intel mix just because of who we are and where we are. But the idea is that, and this is the first year, it'll be the Whitefish Security Summit, and then it'll happen every year, we hope.
And when is it?
So it's next Thursday and Friday here in Whitefish.
So you better send us tickets really fast.
Yeah. But the next, we think the next one is going to be in February because we're having warmer winters out here. So February is still usually good skiing. And if you're not familiar with Whitefish, we have our own ski resort. So you can come talk big thoughts and pontificate about the future of the world. And then you can go skiing at the Whitefish Mountain Resort, or you can go to Glacier National Park. It's going to happen in the summertime, too.
Okay.
It's only 30 minutes that way.
That's the most beautiful.
How about that for an advertisement?
That's the most beautiful place I've ever been, Glacier.
Really? Yes.
Absolutely. Yep. Can I just ask one question about your summits?
Quickly,
sure.
Which is that your opening remarks talked about diplomacy, and you also mentioned diplomacy in your cadre of folks that are coming. Is that, are there former officials that are going to be there? I mean, how do you define the diplomatic element that joins this group?
So yes, there are going to be former, like General McChrystal, I'm on the military side, obviously is one of the keynote speakers. We have a lot of former senior CIA folks. We do have some diplomats. I don't want to necessarily name a lot of them because then a lot of them are publicly named in it. But again, this is I don't think they'd have an issue with it, but I just haven't asked permission. But the idea is, yes, Karen, we are looking to have that combination. We'd love to have a lot of former ambassadors, particularly career ambassadors, who have been told, this is the policy, make it happen, right? And so with the generals, with the CIA station chiefs, to come out here, now that they're not in the government, they might have more ability to talk openly about the current and then potentially future challenges we face as a nation. That's the intent. And again, this is the first year, so we'll see and adjust. But I think the next year and the next year after that, we'll see more of it. And hopefully we'll have more engagement from across the spectrum, particularly diplomats.
That's great.
Well, God willing, inshallah, we will be there next February. Thanks, Mick, for coming on the show. It's been great talking to you. It's an honor, really.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, everybody.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot, guys.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show. Speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark. Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices. NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.